So what's it like to be part of a people that is hated around the world with your neighbors calling for your execution?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
What a privilege and honor it is to be with you on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, right here on the Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, and it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. Any Jewish related question or comment you have, give me a call. If you are one of those who posts on YouTube some type of Jewish conspiratorial comment, some type of evil Israel type comment, Why not call in and enlighten everyone? Why not call in a way where you and I can have a friendly discussion about these things? Sure, I'm laughing because you would not believe some of the stuff that comes in. And we got a lot of things to talk about: terrorism issues, anti-Semitism issues, other world news that ties with Israel. And I want to give you some Jewish insights and thoughts as we go, as always. But I spoke in London about this, what, two Saturdays ago, and then in Alabama last Saturday. I spoke about the irrational, the diabolical nature of anti-Semitism. I explained how anti-Semitism is the world's longest hatred, the world's most widespread hatred, the world's most irrational hatred, and even over a prolonged period of time, the world's most violent hatred. I explained how you cannot possibly connect all the dots logically. Most things, when you have some type of uprising, some type of unusual phenomenon, some type of attitude, some type of mindset that spreads, you can normally figure out where it comes from or how it spreads. But when you have, let's say you just have a disease, and it breaks out simultaneously in five different parts of the world among five different population groups that have no demographic connection, and there's been no physical contact between any of those people and anyone else that's touched the other groups, it becomes more mysterious. When you have something like this happening over centuries, it becomes even more mysterious. That's just a fraction of the diabolical nature of anti-Semitism. There is no logical, rational explanation. The ultimate explanation is what? The devil hates the Jews and wants to exterminate the Jewish people. And if he can do that, he makes God into a liar, because God is on record in the Word as saying that that will never happen, that he will preserve his people, Israel, to the end, no matter what. Yes, under discipline, but preserved by love, not because of our goodness, but because of his goodness. Not because of anything we've done, but because of his love for the patriarchs and the promises that he gave to them. So his promises remain steadfast. If Satan can wipe out the Jewish people, look at Jeremiah 31, verses 35 to 37. If Satan can wipe out the Jewish people, that makes God into a liar. So he can't do that. Well, a Jewish Jerusalem must welcome the Messiah back according to the scriptures. Well, if you can't wipe out the Jewish people, keep them out of Jerusalem and keep Jerusalem out of their hands. And if you can't do that, keep Jewish people away from Jesus. You understand now the nature of the spiritual battle that we are fighting. 866-348-7884 is the number to call with your Jewish-related questions. I want to get to your questions very quickly in the broadcast. Got a lot to cover with you. And remember, now is the time to sign up for our trip to Israel scheduled for next year, February 25th to March 6th. Can't wait to share that time together with you. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Michael Brown. I want to invite you to join me for our second ever trip to Israel, February 25th through March 6th, 2017. This is a great opportunity. I get to interact with you, our radio listening audience, and our ministry partners as we experience the land of Israel together, and it will be a life changer. We've got a great price on the trip, and if you're one of our monthly supporters or torchbearers, you're eligible to receive a special discount for this once-in-a-lifetime experience. Space is limited, and we're accepting applications on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information on the trip to secure your spot, go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the Israel banner, or call our office at 704-782-3760.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the Line of Fire. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. Before I get to your calls, any Jewish-related questions, again, glad to get to them. Dennis Prager last week had a very interesting article. Dennis Prager is always very thoughtful and worth reading. Do Jews, Christians, and Muslims believe in the same God? And here's how he answers the question. He knows the subtleties, and he studied Islam and Christianity as well. So he knows the subtleties and how you can say yes, the same, but not the same, or dogmatically answer with a yes or a no. But here are the questions that he asks. So he says, how do I know if another person believes in the same God that I do? He said, I asked the following three questions. One, do you believe in the God of Israel? He said, those who cannot answer this question in the affirmative do not believe in the same God that believing Jews and the majority of believing Christians do. As for Muslims, they should have no problem answering in the affirmative, but in our time, many wouldn't. And then second question he would ask, does the God you believe in judge the moral behavior of every human being? And then three, do you believe in the God who gave the Ten Commandments? He said, what about people who say yes to these questions but have additional theological beliefs? Do they believe in the same God as those who answer yes but have no additional beliefs? For example, what about Christians who believe in the God of Israel but also believe by definition in the Christian Trinity? Do they believe in the same God as Jews and other non-Christians who solely believe in these three criteria? He says, I think they do. He said, the same would hold true for a Muslim who believes in these three notions, but also believes that the Quran is the only full, valid revelation. Whether or not one uses these three criteria, we should all at least acknowledge that saying one believes in God tells us nothing about the God one believes in. And regarding faith, that is what matters. That's Dennis Prager's perspective, which is certainly an interesting perspective. All right. Growing up as a Jewish person, even though I went to school with non-Jews and I had very good friends that were non-Jews, and we all hung out together, we played sports together, went to the same school. Now, the little community I lived in called Harbor Isle, which is part of Island Park, which itself is a small town right near Long Beach, which many people know in the South Shore of Long Island. So Island Park was the name of the place I grew up, but within Island Park, we didn't have our own zip code. We were part of Island Park zip code. But within Island Park, there was a little community called Harbor Isle with maybe 300 families. And when I grew up, Harbor Isle was almost all Jewish, but almost no religious Jews. It was much more of a secular, fairly nominal Jewish community. So in keeping with that, on Sabbath service, a Saturday morning, my dad would sometimes get an emergency call. Abe, we need you. Because they did not have the required number of men called the minyan, which just means number, but means 10. You have to have at least 10 men for the prayer services to be official and as if recognized by God, to oversimplify that. And sometimes you get an emergency call, he just get dressed quick, you know, get cleaned up quick and head down to the synagogue so they'd have a minyan. But they had to build an annex for the High Holy Days because hundreds would want to come for that. So that was typical of the Jewish community in which I grew up. Nonetheless, even though we were friends with all of our non-Jewish friends, even though I don't remember hearing anti-Jewish jokes growing up, even though I don't remember us cracking jokes about the Goyim, the Gentiles, or looking down at them. And as I got a little older, my best friends were non-Jews. So even though that was the case, there's still the mentality. There's still the mentality of us and them. There's the Jewish people, and there is the rest of the world. That's just how you feel growing up. And if you are more religious, you feel it even more because you're more isolated and living by the commandments and therefore more separated from the rest of the society by your dress, your appearance, your lifestyle. But there's still a perception of us and them. I've often said it, but as a boy, I thought Christian, Gentile, Protestant, Catholic were virtually synonymous. And because the Gentiles I knew were Christian, and they were as nominal as I was, they were nominal Christians, I was a nominal Jew, it was all kind of one blur. Gentile, Christian, I mean, Catholic, Protestant, I guess we knew there was some difference there, but it's all the same. It was us and them. Well, when you live in the land of Israel, it's a little different dynamic. You have many Arabs living among you. 6 million Jews, 1.5 million Arabs or Palestinians. So you do actually have a very mixed society. And then you have Jews from around the world. So you have Jews who are dark-skinned, Jews who are light-skinned, Jews who are Asian, Jews who are Western, Jews who are African, Jews who are Middle Eastern. You have that melting pot, but then you're surrounded by radical Muslims. And you always live in an environment where it seems the world is always against you, that everything is Israel's fault. And from the Palestinian perspective, they are the oppressed people. This monster Goliath is oppressing the poor little Davids. And obviously, as far as military might, Israel versus Hamas or Palestinian Authority, yeah, it would be Goliath versus David. But when you look at Israel surrounded by a hostile world, then the equation changes. But for the Palestinian perspective, they're the oppressed minority. So check this out. A statue of Nelson Mandela has been unveiled where? In the West Bank city of Ramallah. Listen to this report.
A 6-meter-tall statue of Nelson Mandela has been unveiled in the West Bank city of Ramallah. The city's mayor attended the ceremony and said it's the first statue South Africa has given outside its border and is part of a relationship between Ramallah and Johannesburg.
Right, so it also sends a message that Nelson Mandela, the freedom fighter against apartheid in South Africa, is a hero to the Palestinian people. By the way, he's been quoted out of context as if he bashed Israel in the past, and that's a complete quote out of context. It stops a quote midway through his speech and does not listen to the rest of what he says. It's really fairly blatant to do that. In any case, this would be the Palestinian perception. They are freedom fighters. They are fighting against evil apartheid Israel. And that's why they have a statue, a 9-foot statue of Nelson Mandela. From the Israeli perspective, they are surrounded by radical Muslims who want to kill them, who incite all types of hatred and violence against them, who believe that killing a Jew is a wonderful way to get entrance to the world to come, to have favor as a Muslim. So this is what Israel is surrounded by. I've got some quotes. Here we go. Let me just do this quickly. Former governor of the Palestinian Monetary Authority, Dr. Fuad Beseso. Global Judaism is a virus. This is from this month, April. Global Judaism is a virus. It's behind the financial crisis, and it's in line with the protocols of the Elders of Zion. It's just a little summary. And then Jordanian cleric Abu Qatada al-Filistini, he states that Jews use blood for Passover monsters. To this day, they still believe these things. That's what Israel is surrounded by, people who believe they are responsible for all the suffering in the world, people who believe that they are the evil occupiers, people who believe that there's a Jewish conspiracy to take over the world, control the banks, control the money, control the media. And what do the protocols of the Elders of Zion say? This is a forged document, probably by Russian secret police, over 100 years old, which claims to record conversations overheard at a cemetery where a group of Jews was secretly meeting to plot taking over the world. It's believed to this day in much of the Muslim world and even outside of the Muslim world by Jew haters and things like that. And what does it say? Yeah, that the group of 300 Jewish leaders secretly waiting for the right opportunity to rise up and take over the world. And what are they going to do? I've read it with my own eyes. They're going to bring the whole world in subjection to the Hindu god Vishnu. You say, what? Yeah. Complete, utter, total nonsense. Absurd. It's almost like Satan saying, if you're going to believe a lie, we'll make it really crazy. That's what Israel is up against. We'll be right back with your calls, 866-34-TRUTH.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Make me glad by your deeds, O Lord, so I sing for joy at all your hands have made. How great are your works, O Lord, Elohim.
So join me. Join me in Israel next year with my dear friend Scott Volk for the tour of a lifetime. We'll have meals together. I'll be doing teaching at selected sites, key times. Together where we can really open the word, an amazing tour, great accommodations, a great tour guide, special things we get to do on these tours that many other tours don't do. You connect directly with Messianic Jewish and Arab believers in the land. Very, very special time. And some of the nights, you'll join me if you like as I do my live radio show from Israel. Yeah, the whole thing, Sea of Galilee, boat ride and baptisms in the River Jordan and praying at the wall in Jerusalem. So to find out about this trip, I'm so excited about it. After doing one 2 years ago and seeing the impact of the people and what a great deal it was, I'm really excited about next year's tour. So go to Ask Dr. Brown. We just announced it this week. AskDrBrown.org, AskDrBrown.org. Click on the Israel banner to find out more. And the voice you heard singing, leading us in on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, my dear friend and colleague, Paul Wilbur. Any Jewish-related question? The phones are open. We go to the phones now. Washington, D.C. Lee, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you.
Quick question, Michael. Why do you think there's such hostility among the Jewish community and the African-American community?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mystery. Well, let me say this. It's not a total mystery, but historically, it's a bit of a mystery because the Jewish population in America, African-American population in America, these were populations that were discriminated against. Obviously, we didn't have slavery for the Jews in America. But if you think of Jews today as very prosperous and influential, it wasn't always like that in America. You go back to the early 20th century and you couldn't get into some of the best universities just as a student if you were a Jew. I was talking to one gentleman whose mother died a few years back in her late 90s, maybe the last year or so. And when she was 16, so say 85 years ago, she was going to go to the beach for her birthday. And when she got there, the sign said, however blacks were described, colored, Negroes, whatever, no Negroes, no Jews. So there's been a common history of persecution, Jews as slaves out of Egypt, Jews hated around the world. African-Americans suffering so terribly here in America. And in the early days of the civil rights movement, Jews marched arm in arm. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel marching together with Dr. Martin Luther King. Those things happen. And yet today there's a real deep divide in many ways. And think of this also, Lee. American Jews overwhelmingly vote Democratic.
Absolutely.
Over 80%. And over 90% of African Americans vote Democrat. So you'd think there's a lot in common in terms of certain ideas and shared values, but I think ultimately, and again, it's speculation here. I know why Jews have gone the more liberal way. more secular Jews are more humanistic, therefore they're pro-abortion, therefore they're pro-redefining marriage, therefore they're concerned about any type of right-wing religious government that they think would oppress them or take away their rights. Where Black Americans vote Democratic, they tend to be more conservative. Many of them tend to be pro-life and pro-family, and yet it's the social issues and what they feel are the social benefits of the Democratic Party that they vote in that direction. But I think ultimately, and I could be wrong on this, Lee, that you end up with a bit of a situation that's perceived as the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah.
That it seems the Jews are better educated and the Jews are more prosperous and the Jews are higher. You know, they're living. And again, I'm giving gross stereotypes here.
Sure.
But they're living in the nice suburbs and the Blacks are living in more difficult parts of the inner city. Again, I'm giving over-exaggerated stereotypes. But if that's the feeling and the perception, then there's going to be some type of hostility. And you've got Jewish sinful flesh that can maybe look down at somebody else or categorize them negatively. And then you've got Black sinful flesh that could judge others that seem to have more. It could be that simple. There may be more to it, though.
Okay.
Do you have any opinion on it?
I mean, I agree with regards to the social issue and also the perception that, you know, African-Americans, the Jews are the well-off or the haves with regards to living in this country. But as a young African-American, I find a lot of my friends, we desire to reach out and embrace other ethnic groups, the racial groups, but sometimes it's difficult due to the fact that the stereotype, you know, if I come to you, approach you, I'm being perceived as threatening. And that kind of shuns a lot of African-Americans from even reaching out due to the perception of us.
Yeah, the thing that's so odd, and look, we're not talking about, say, sitting down with an ultra-Orthodox Jew that is very much absorbed with keeping the commandments and living an insular life, you know, raising his or her family in a way in accordance with the Torah and Jewish tradition. We're talking about just your average, more secular Jew. I think if you're in the right environment, that most Jews in that regard would pride themselves on being open-minded and would pride themselves on being tolerant and not discriminatory, because we know what it's like to be discriminated against as a people. And I think if you're in a setting like a college setting or working together shoulder to shoulder in the workplace, that the divisions aren't going to be there, that the divisions between African-Americans and American Jews really aren't going to be there because of the, you know, the shared values of wanting to be embracing and so on, and both recognizing the wrongness of discrimination or judging people by religion or skin color. But it seems to just be somehow larger than that. And look, let's not rule the devil out. The devil hates both. I mean, I look at, for example, the extraordinarily high percentage of African-American babies getting aborted. And I look at that as Satan's war on African-Americans. The same with prison population. And I know there's societal issues and you could ascribe blame here and there, but I look at it as the devil trying to wipe out a people. Look, in point of fact, African-Americans tend to be much more people of faith, religious, open to the gospel.
Absolutely.
than their white counterparts, right? So I see the devil attacking in that regard. And then on the Jewish regard, the devil's always trying to exterminate and destroy Jewish people. And I think, for me, it's interesting. I've always felt a special connection with my African-American brothers and sisters in the Lord. I've often talked about just enjoying much more preaching in an African-American church than a typical white church.
I hear that a lot.
Yeah, yeah, and it's sincere. I mean, there's the joke always, as a drummer, I like to clap on the upbeat, you know, but there's a certain shared soul. It's almost like a depth of life history and experience. And so I've always resonated and felt a deep connection, and it could just be the enemy working against it. But hey, we continue to build bridges, and hopefully at least in the body, in the church, we can really show that unity. And I've been to many Messianic Jewish congregations that have many African Americans there too. They really do feel a shared connection. Thank you for the call.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you for joining us on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. I am blessed and delighted to be with you. Oh, you know, a lot of things happening in the secular world, and I'm not going to get into it because we try to keep our Jewish focus. But let me just say this quickly. When I wrote my book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, came out September of last year, I said that gay activists will overplay their hands, that the movement that was built as a movement of victims will become victimizers. The movement that was built on the backs of those who were bullied for being LGBT, that those very people leading that movement will become and have become the bullies. That gay activism will overplay its hand in that the transgender emphasis will go too far. And it'll get to the point where people say, wait, this is crazy. What are we doing? This is moral, social, cultural insanity. And that's where we're at right now. I was listening to a news report, and the host, I don't know if MSNBC or what, but a liberal station, if I recall, he was saying, hey, there's some real pushback. And he was noting that the petition against Target, let me just see where it's at right now. The petition to boycott Target in a little over a week, where is it at? 978,776 signatures. So reached almost a million signatures in a little bit over a week. That's an extraordinary, extraordinary statement to Target saying you've gone too far. And the pushback on social media, video after video and testimony after testimony, story after story. Of course. And Congressman Louie Gohmert had something very interesting to say. He said, look, as an attorney and getting involved with victims of sexual abuse, it's well over 20% of the female population has reported being sexually abused, including rape, but not only rape. And that's only a part of how many have actually been abused or raped that never come forward and reported, or their reports aren't believed. And he's saying, okay, in contrast, those who identify as transgender are maybe 2 or 3 out of 1,000, as opposed to 2 or 300 out of 1,000. He said, so why are you going to disregard the sensitivities of the women who've been abused or raped to accommodate the 2 or 3 out of 1,000 that are struggling with their gender identity? And again, it's at that point, it's at that moment. We have been sounding the alarm. We have been equipping you. We have been informing you not to hate others, but to do what's right. Not to despise others, but to act with moral sanity and spiritual clarity. And how about this one? With common sense? Is that too much to ask? A little common sense? So that's where we are today, friends. And as distressing as the moment is, it's also a healthy moment. 866-348-7884. I am going to take some questions being posted right now on Facebook and Twitter as well. Normally, I don't have time to do that on a Thursday, but I'm going to take some of those on a Thursday as well. I want to talk to you about anti-Semitism in the UK. I want to give you some Jewish insights, Jewish ways of looking at things, looking at the scriptures, perhaps some things you haven't known or seen before, as we have a great time together on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And yeah, look, I'm looking at a report from Times of Israel. In spiraling anti-Semitism row, Labor suspends Livingston for saying Hitler-backed Zionism. Speaking of Ken Livingston. Yeah, anti-Semitism in Europe and around the world continues to swirl out of control in ways just where it was at the beginning of the Holocaust, or even worse. It's bad news, but it reminds us of the spiritual realities. It reminds us of why we stand where we stand. We'll be right back.
Change the world. join Dr. Michael Brown along with Messianic Jewish pastor Scott Volk for a unique behind-the-scenes tour of Israel, February 25th through March 6th, 2017. Space is limited, so we're accepting applications on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information on the trip and to secure your spot, please visit our website at AskDrBrown.org and click on the Israel Tour banner or call our office at 704-782-3760.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Over on Facebook, I posted a picture. I love to do this. It's always one of my favorite things to do. When we have a new book that comes in, we take pre-orders, and it's a special kind of collector's edition from the very first printing. It's the book. We number the copies that I'm going to sign. So somebody gets number one, somebody gets number 20, someone may get number 185, depending on how many of these come in. Pre-ordered books, and I sign them. They are numbered, and I put a scripture reference in there. So I've posted a picture on Facebook. We got our advanced copies of The Grace Controversy in. The book will be released to the general public next week. Let's see, Tuesday of next week, May 3rd, it'll be released. So you can order your copy however you like. But thrilled to make that available. And right after the show, I'm going to sit down and start signing those. I also posted on Facebook, if you have questions that you'd like to ask, Jewish-related questions, I'm going to take some of those as well as on Twitter. So let me, before I go to your questions, and if you want to call the question, 866-34-TRUTH, Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 29, says this: "The secret things belong to the Lord our God, to Yahweh our God. But those things that are revealed, they belong to us and to our children forever, to observe, to do all the words of this law, this teaching, this Torah." Now, when I came to faith, my perception of the law was negative, negative, negative. And the idea was, thank God we're not under the law. And boy, how difficult it was. And all those commandments and all the technical things and the clean and the unclean and the pure and the impure and on and on and on and on and on and on. And of course, we have a new and better covenant in life in the Spirit in Yeshua, which is the ultimate goal that God was moving towards. But when I first started talking with religious Jews, I realized, wow, their perspective was very different. Their perspective was, out of all the peoples in the earth, God gave us his Torah, that we have this special gift. And that's certainly reflected in Psalm 19 and Psalm 119. And in fact, if you read Romans 7, Paul says, in itself, the law is holy, just, and good. It's spiritual. The problem is sinful nature. And part of the reason the Torah was given was to expose human sin and to expose flesh and to get us in a posture of recognizing our need for redemption, a need for atonement, need for a Savior. But it's very interesting that there's a traditional Jewish interpretation of Deuteronomy 29:29 that says this, and it's 29:28 in Hebrew, just versification is one different. The traditional Jewish interpretation, one of them says this: the secret things belong to the Lord our God, and the revealed things to us and our children forever is to observe, to do all the words of this Torah. So the grammatical interpretation, the most natural interpretation, the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but that which is open, that which is open and revealed, belongs to us and to our children to do all the words of this law forever. But there's a Jewish interpretation that reads a little differently and even puts the emphasis even more on the privilege, the honor of keeping the Torah. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, and the revealed things too. But for us is observing the Torah. And of course, that is a wonderful, zealous attitude. In Acts 21, Jacob, James says, look, there are tens of thousands of Jews who believe in Yeshua the Messiah, and they're all zealous for the law. The problem is the law in itself cannot save. The law in itself cannot bring us into the Messianic kingdom. The Torah in itself cannot help us to deal with the ultimate root cause of sin in our lives. And therefore, we must have a Messiah. And that's why Paul says in Romans 3 that faith does not abolish the law. It establishes it. All right, let me answer some questions that have been posted. Let's see here. On Twitter, here are a couple of questions. All right, let me just get back to the right page. Now, I posted on Twitter and said I'm going to answer on the air. I'm going to answer on the air. And therefore, I certainly hope you're listening because I'm not answering on Twitter. Gospel Tracts and Noah both want to know about how do Jews typically interpret Isaiah 53. And Gospel Tracts also want to know how Jews typically interpret Psalm 22. We'll start with Psalm 22. There are wide ranges of Jewish interpretation, but there are two primary ways that Psalm 22 is read. One, it's the Psalm of David, or just an ancient suffering Israelite delivered from the jaws of death. And you would presume that it's an Israelite leader because of the dimensions, of the deliverance and the praise that it brings to the ends of the earth. That's one reason I pressed the Messianic application. But just an individual psalm of suffering and deliverance. There's another interpretation that says it is a poetic, figurative description of Israel's history. That it's not just one person, one time, but it is a picture of Israel's history and ultimately delivered from the jaws of death to the praise of the ends of the earth. It is not typically interpreted messianically. However, there is a traditional writing called Pesikta Rabbati. These were Sabbath sermons from different portions of the Hebrew scriptures outside of the Torah, and probably from around the 8th or 9th century. And there's a section, really over a couple of chapters, chapter 36 being the key one, that speaks a lot about the suffering Messiah. And language from Psalm 22 is put on the suffering Messiah's lips as he suffers in heaven and somehow bears the burden and the pain of the Jewish people on earth, that his suffering preserves them and is important for their redemption. Other than that, it is not primarily interpreted as a messianic psalm. As for Isaiah 53, the passage begins in 52:13 and continues on to 53:12. 52:13 on through 53:12. And the most common interpretation is that it refers to the nation of Israel. There are some ancient midrashic homiletical commentaries, or I should say citations of Isaiah 53, some applying it to the Messiah, some applying it to the righteous within Israel, some applying it to Moses or others. And there are Jews to this day who believe it's speaking of a suffering Messiah. Some say part of it is speaking of a suffering Messiah and others of a triumphant Messiah. Some would argue that it's speaking of the Messiah suffering in heaven on our behalf. But the primary interpretation that you'll find, not universally, but almost universally, is that it's speaking of the nation of Israel or the righteous remnant within the nation of Israel. And that Isaiah 53 contains the testimony of the Gentile nations, the kings of the nations. 52:15 says that what we had not heard, we're now hearing things and shutting our mouths because of that. So Isaiah 53:1 then starts with who has believed what we have heard. Our report is literally what we have heard. So they said, see, that's the Gentile nations, the kings speaking. And the kings are saying, boy, we misjudged Israel. Boy, we thought Israel scattered among the nations was suffering for its sins. We didn't realize that Israel was really suffering for our sins, that we oppressed Israel, and that's why they were suffering. That would be the primary way that it is understood, and that the nations, the earth, the kings will be astonished when God's favor for Israel is revealed at the end of the age. Now, they would also point to Isaiah beginning the 41st chapter that repeatedly Israel is spoken of as God's servant, my servant Israel, Jacob, my servant, Isaiah 40 through 55. It's a major theme there. So that tells us it's Israel, it's Jacob. The big problem with that, of course, is that the servant is righteous and is suffering terribly. If it spoke of the nation as a whole, like, they couldn't work. Because if it was Israel as a whole that was righteous, then that would mean that Israel would be the head, not the tail. Israel would be blessed, not cursed. Otherwise, God would have to throw out the Sinai covenant where he assured those things and the blessings and the curses in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. So that can't possibly work. That's one of the reasons that it's argued it's the righteous remnant within Israel. They were righteous and yet suffering because of the sins of the nations. And when God raises them up, the nations will see God is with Israel. Again, the problem there is that the suffering of the servant in Isaiah 53 brings healing. It by his wounds we're healed. That is not the case with the righteous remnant, as the righteous remnant suffered in exile. It didn't bring blessing to the nations. It brought judgment on the nations. So it breaks down. Ultimately, it must be interpreted with regard to Jesus.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
His policy in 32 when he won that election was to deport Germany's Jews to Israel. And the Zionist movement had secret meetings with his administration talking about that.
Ken Livingston claiming that Hitler backed Zion. The former mayor of London said that he has brought his Labour Party into disrepute. A colleague calls him a Nazi apologist and a disgusting racist. This is some of European anti-Semitism. This is some of what is dealt with. These myths, these horrible libels, there are people who widely believe them and then often take out their anger and hatred against Jewish people in literally deadly ways. Let's listen to clip number 5, more about what's happening in England.
Now, she's profusely apologized for them, said she made a mistake. If she's apologized for them, presumably she acknowledges that they were anti-Semitic. Do you still maintain they were not?
No, she's a deep critic of Israel and its policies. Her remarks were over the top. But she's not anti-Semitic. I've been in the Labour Party for 47 years. I've never heard anyone say anything anti-Semitic. I've heard a lot of criticism of the state of Israel and its abuse of the Palestinians, but I've never heard someone be anti-Semitic.
She talked about relocating Israel to America. She talked about what Hitler did being legal. And she talked about the Jews rallying. And she used the word Jews, not Israelis or Israel. You didn't find that to be anti-Semitic?
No, it's completely over the top. It's not anti-Semitic. I mean, let's remember, when Hitler won his election in 1932, his policy then was that Jews should be moved to Israel. He was supporting Zionism. And his boy went mad and I ended up killing 6 million Jews. But the simple fact in all of this is that Naz made these comments at a time when there's another brutal Israeli attack on the Palestinians. And there's one stark fact that virtually no one in the British media ever reports. In almost all these conflicts, the death toll is usually between 60 and 100 Palestinians killed for every Israeli.
Yeah, so that was Ken Livingston. He has been suspended by his party, Labour, because of those dastardly comments. And they were speaking about another parliamentarian, Naz Shah, who was suspended a few days back over a Facebook post that she made, which supported the relocation of Israelis to the USA. So this is what's out there. This is in the media. This is what's being talked about. It's destructive. It's deadly. Oh, you know, Hitler this and Hitler supported Zionism. And yeah, it's just the Israelis are so brutal towards the Palestinians. And that's the issue. Let's face the fact. It goes back to a demonic anti-Semitism. And that's why you have it across cultures. That's why you have it across centuries. That's why you have it in every demographic you can imagine, Jew hatred being a common denominator. All right, let me go back to, let's see, I answered some Twitter questions. Let me go over to Facebook where some questions are posted as well. Let's see here. Okay. Let me slide down. Here we go. Julie. My Jewish friend says that there was never any Jewish concept of a Messiah that included having that Messiah be anything other than a man born to earthly parents. The Jewish Messiah would be a man, not a God-man. Jews reject the deification of any human being. Julie, I also reject the deification of a human being. I absolutely embrace the biblical testimony that God can tabernacle among us, that the eternal God, who is complex in his unity, can sit enthroned in heaven, can fill the universe with his presence, and can tabernacle among us in human form if he so chooses to. Hence, John 1:14, the Word became flesh. Does not say God became human or a human became God. That would imply that God ceased to be God in heaven or that a human being became God. Rather, the Word, which is God and yet with God, the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us, literally pitched his tent among us. And through the Word who makes God known, we now understand God better. Now, the concept of the Word revealing God, that's a very Jewish concept called the Memra in Aramaic. The idea of God, his presence dwelling among us, his Shekhinah, his dwelling presence, that's a Jewish concept. The idea of God being complex in his unity, that's also a Jewish concept. The Sfirot, the ten Sfirot, or emanations, divine emanations, that's found in Jewish mysticism. But as to the question of the Messiah, there are texts that speak of a highly exalted Messiah, not a divine Messiah, but a highly exalted Messiah, a Messiah of even angelic status. I get into it in great detail in Volume 2 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, Volume 2 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, as well as in shorter form in The Real Kosher Jesus. You can read more if you go to realmessiah.com and look up objections. You'll see that very objections. Jews don't believe in a divine Messiah. Through history, there have been pictures of a highly exalted Messiah. But yes, otherwise, the main Jewish concept is that the Messiah will be a man like us and it will be raised up and exalted by God. But the Hebrew Scriptures point to the divine nature of the Messiah. There are passages, for example, Isaiah, the 9th chapter, being the most prominent, that point to the divine nature of the Messiah. So your Jewish friend is partly right and partly wrong. The bigger question is, what does the Scripture say? Joel, in Matthew 15 and Mark 8, the story of Jesus feeding the 4,000 is recorded. In recent study, I've learned that some scholars say that that was a largely Gentile audience. I have trouble believing that for many reasons. Do you have any insight into that? I don't see it as a primarily Gentile audience. I don't see any compelling reason to see it as a primarily Gentile audience, frankly. So there may be some scholars arguing for it, but I see no compelling reason to myself. Let's just see here. That question is too long, but I'll come back to it next hour for those that will be listening. Laura. What did you say in response to the question when asked how they will know the Messiah when there's no longer actual lineage available? How do they know the sons of Aaron as well? Some things have just been preserved through the centuries where family name, for example, name Cohen or Levi would point to Cohen, Aaronic descent, and Levi, Levitical descent. And then through DNA, there's also testing that can pretty well identify a descent. That's one thing. Some even claim that through DNA they can identify Davidic descent. But basically, when someone who claims Davidic descent, that part would be disputed, who claims Davidic descent begins to do what the traditional Messiah is expected to do, bring Israel into obedience to the Torah, fight the wars of the Lord, regather the exiles, rebuild Jerusalem, establish peace on the earth. Well, if someone does that claiming Davidic descent, as they do all those things, you'd say, well, that's got to be them. That's got to be the Messiah. That would be how it would be recognized. Remember to visit the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Click on the Israel banner to find out about our tour next year. My bottom line is this. To this day, there is no rational explanation for anti-Semitism. It is demonic and it is destructive. So what's it like to be part of a people that is hated around the world with your neighbors calling for your execution.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Yes, it is. Sometimes I'm trying to think, okay, what day of the week is it, just because of constant travel and radio. It's like, okay, what day is today? It's like, did I do Thoroughly Jewish? No, it's Wednesday. No, it's Friday. You've got questions. So I know what day of the week it is by what I'm doing on radio. This is Michael Brown. I am delighted to be with you. 866-34-TRUTH. Let me share something with you. From the Fatah student movement, this is the political party of Mahmoud Abbas, the chairman of the Palestinian Authority. And Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement is promoting its student movement, Shabiba's election campaign at Birzeit University, by posting the above poster on its official Facebook page. I'm looking at the picture. You can see it on palwatch.org. Palwatch.org. I'm looking at the poster myself, and the poster shows a knife dripping with blood. This is a Facebook page of the student movement of Fatah, and it is promoting the election of the Fatah student movement on the Palestinian Birzeit University campus. All right? It shows a knife dripping with blood. It is shaped as the Palestinian Authority's map of, quote, Palestine, that includes the PA areas as well as all of Israel. The entire map is painted in the colors of the Palestinian flag, implying Palestinian political sovereignty over Israel. And the text on the poster says, plant it in the heart of your enemy. Yeah. Uh-huh. Plant it in the heart of your enemy. So what's it telling you? It's telling you, number one, that this is anything but a movement that wants to have peace with Israel and coexist. Anything but. That's number one. Number two, it is saying that we will overtly advertise, promote murderous violence against Jewish people. You might say, yeah, but sometimes the Israelis are hostile towards Palestinians, or they've even wanted, you know, if someone tries to attack an Israeli, you know, some guy just tries to stab you and you catch him, better to kill him. Yeah, I know there is some anger. You have to realize that when you have women in their 70s walking on the street getting attacked and stabbed to death, boy 13 years old on his bicycle getting attacked and stabbed, and on, hundreds and hundreds of attacks and dozens of casualties, and then Hamas celebrating the bus blast, what, a little over a week and a half ago. These things going on a regular basis, you can understand some of the hostility. But this is it. I keep looking at it. It's extraordinary to see, but that's what Israel is dealing with. And for those who say, oh, Israel has a peace partner, it does not have a peace partner. Obviously not Hamas, but not the Palestinian Authority either. All right, I'm going to take your Jewish-related questions today, 866-348-7884. I'm also going to be answering Jewish-related questions posted on Twitter or on Facebook. Ask Dr. Brown on Facebook. So if you're unable to call, but you can post to my Twitter account, Dr. Michael L. Brown, Dr. Michael L. Brown. Make sure you get two L's in the middle. Or on Facebook, Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown, then we can answer your questions, as many as we can, on the air. I won't be answering on Facebook or Twitter, but on the air, I will be. 866-348-7884.
Fire we want, for fire we want.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The Maccabees, singing Let My People Go. This is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-348-7884 with your Jewish-related questions. I'm going to go back over to Facebook, and let's see here. Okay, answered that. Let's try this one. How do you explain to observant Jews that Jesus is the Messiah when the Torah tells them not to listen to false prophets who lead them away from God's commandments, Deuteronomy 13? Most Christian churches teach that followers of Jesus are free to disregard some of God's commandments, such as the Sabbath. I personally don't believe the New Testament teaches that we are free to disregard the commandments like the Sabbath. Nevertheless, that's what the majority of Christian churches teach. Therefore, in order to be in harmony with the Torah and New Testament scriptures, shouldn't Christians revisit this issue and remove the stumbling block from our Jewish friends so that they can clearly see that Jesus is not a false prophet who tells his followers to disregard certain commandments? Indeed, he affirmed the validity of Torah in Matthew 5, 17 to 19. Great question, David. Number one, you are not going to erase church history. You are not going to erase 2,000 years of the church teaching that Christians are not obligated to observe all of the Torah. So, and you're not going to suddenly get Christians around the world to say, okay, we're going to observe all the Torah. Secondly, it's not just Sabbath. It's everything in Torah. And that's not going to happen. It's not possible, number one, to obey many of the forever commands of the Torah. And it's certainly contrary to the spirit of the New Testament that all Christians are required to keep all of the Jewish law. Absolutely not. That would undo one of the purposes of the Messiah coming into the world, which was to bring Gentiles into the kingdom of God along with Jews without Gentiles having to become Jews. So the better question would be, what about Jewish believers in Jesus, the Messiah? Well, in the earliest church or congregation, for decades, what was the witness? The Jews continued to observe the Torah. Messianic Jews observed the Torah. Paul pointed out that he didn't violate the traditions of his people. Acts 21, Jacob James says to Paul, look, you see how many tens of thousands of Jewish believers there are here, and they're all zealous for the Torah. And we have documented that for several centuries, at least three or four, some say five or six, some say even into the beginning of the Muslim era, there were Jewish believers who continued to live as Jews, not following the rabbinic traditions which had developed. So not following the Judaism of their day, but as Jews observing the Sabbath and celebrating the Passover as followers of Yeshua at the same time. And others in the church didn't get it and had an issue with it. And in our day, there's been a great restoration of that with Messianic Jewish congregations all around the world. So in point of fact, we can easily say, yeah, Jesus did not abolish the law. He brought it to fulfillment. He brought to fulfillment the Torah and the prophets. Now, here's the thing. As I said, the vast majority of the forever commandments of the Torah Jews cannot keep without a standing, functioning temple, functioning priesthood, Jewish sovereignty in the land. So Yeshua has come, fulfilled everything that was spoken of, and now has initiated the new and better covenant. Either that, or Jewish people around the world are not able to do most of what God commanded, especially in terms of forever commandments. 75% of the forever commandments, Jewish people cannot perform. So did God leave us empty, or did Yeshua bring to fulfillment that which was written in the Torah and prophets, and now has given us a new and better way? For more on that, volume 4 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. Let's see. Carrie, why after reading Old Testament chapters like Isaiah 53 and Psalm 22, as well as types and shadows like the Passover blood on the doorframes and the sacrifice, or at least the testing of Isaac, are today's Jews still in denial that Jesus is in fact the Messiah? One reason is that they're reading it from a very different perspective. Now, I'm not comparing these. I am not comparing these, but I want to make a point. When Muslims try to claim, well, we have Muhammad in the Bible. You have Mahmud, which means beloved or desirable. You have that in Song of Solomon, and that's the name of Muhammad. See, it's prophesied there. So what kind of rubbish is that? It's just a Hebrew word. It has nothing to do with Muhammad. And when the Islamic claim that when Jesus speaks of the Spirit, I'm going to send the Comforter or the Counselor, I'm going to send the Spirit, that's actually not the Spirit, that's Muhammad. We say that's utter bunk, that's rubbish, and it is. Now, from a traditional Jewish perspective, that's what we're doing. They see us as painting Jesus into the Scriptures. They see us as making him fit. They claim the New Testament was written to make it look as if he fit. That, and so types and shadows, we see that, but others wouldn't. Now, that being said, when the Holy Spirit opens up someone's eyes to see, it becomes crystal clear. And many Jewish people have come to faith reading Isaiah 53, for example. Their eyes were opened. And because of Jewish rejection of the Messiah, Paul says there is a hardness of heart, a veil. Of course, traditional Jews would be very offended by that concept, but they would say on some level, I'm deceived or I'm misled. So what we're saying is as simple as this. When you factor Jesus out and he's not in the equation anymore, you read the Scriptures through different eyes, and it's through those eyes that you'll now see things. It's almost a natural hardening to another point of view. But we continue to pray for the opening of hearts and minds. Also, look, church history has often been terribly brutal towards Jewish people. And because of that, Jesus is associated with church history and therefore cannot possibly be the Messiah. Jennifer, why won't the Jewish people accept any of the New Testament when it was written by the Jews? It doesn't matter it's written by the Jews. There's lots of literature in the ancient world written by Jews. The people of the Dead Sea Scrolls, they're Jews. The Sadducees, who were competing with the Pharisees for the leadership of the people, those are Jews. And these different groups were hostile to each other. So just because something was written by Jews doesn't make it sacred. Do religious Jews today say read the writings of Karl Marx? He was a Jew. The Communist Manifesto? You know, would they do that? Well, no, because it's atheistic and it's hostile to God's purposes and so on and so forth. So just because something's written by Jews doesn't mean that Jews are going to read it or accept it. That being said, many Jews look at the New Testament as a foreign book. To the extent we can get them to recognize it's written by first century Jews about the Jewish Messiah, then a great door is open. Laura, why do Jewish people say they want to follow Jesus but don't realize that he is Jewish and following him means following what he did and lived? He is the way, right? Yeah, Laura, we recognize Jesus as the Jewish Messiah, but Jesus never required Gentiles to live as Jews. In fact, the New Testament explicitly says not to. 1 Corinthians 7. When you're saved circumcised, don't become uncircumcised. So you're saved as a Jew, living as a Jew, don't start to live as a Gentile. You're saved uncircumcised, so as a Gentile, don't become circumcised. Don't try to become a Jew. Because as far as salvation and relationship with God, circumcision is nothing. It has no bearing on the equation. So what matters is a moral life lived out in obedience to the God of Israel, but that does not mean all of the commandments that God gave to Israel. That being said, to the extent we can recognize the Jewish roots of the faith, it is enriching and helpful. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's just see here. Hang on. Don't want to answer all the questions from the same person. Carrie, ask this. I recently watched a video about the Dead Sea Scrolls and how they are similar to the Christian text. The claim is that Jesus and his students were Essenes and had adopted a mystical interpretation of the Tanakh that included spiritual beliefs that came from Babylon. What are your thoughts? Spiritual beliefs that came from Babylon? Nonsense. Remember, by the way, there is a thriving Jewish community in Babylon. And the major Talmud that is studied by Jewish people, the Talmud, because there are two, there's the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud, but the Talmud, the one that studied day and night in yeshivas, that's the Babylonian Talmud. So there is a thriving Jewish community in Babylon through the centuries. And even up to recent centuries in Iraq, they were still there, part of that same ancient community. But to say that the New Testament writers were Essenes, no. I mean, look, people, there have been all these theories around for decades, every new theory and idea. The fact is, that there are concepts in the Dead Sea Scrolls that indicate the idea of Jews expecting a messianic figure or messianic figures, a priestly and a royal a messianic figure. The Jewish community feeling that they were part of an end times community. It was the final battle between the sons of light and the sons of darkness, and that there was a new and better covenant that God had made. Those themes are in the New Testament. But the inbreaking of the kingdom of God, the inbreaking of the messianic movement through Jesus was radically different than what took place among the Essenes. So some similar common concepts, but none that go to Babylon.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you for being part of our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. In the first hour, I talked about the anti-Semitism that exists in Europe, the UK facing it now, even with parliamentary members. And I'm just looking for an article here. No, not that one. Okay. There's an article by James Bloodworth, "The Left Must Confront Its Ugly Anti-Semitism Problem." And he makes reference to Malia Bouatia is the new NUS president, the NUS being what? All right, we'll figure that out. Her comments being a pertinent example of this phenomenon where anti-Semitism permeates institutions and political organizations. Bloodworth says it's easy enough to call out the thugs who proudly sport swastikas and emit unmitigated Jew hatred, yet anti-Semitic assumptions and tropes have entered the mainstream in far more ambiguous forms. Grab clip number three. Before I go to the phones and back to Facebook and Twitter questions, let's listen to what Malia Bouatia has to say.
With mainstream Zionist-led media outlets, because once again we're dealing with a population of the global south, resistance is presented as an act of terrorism. But instead of us remembering that this has always been the case throughout struggles against white supremacy, it's become an accepted discourse amongst too many. When there's a desire to engage in discussions of Palestinian resistance in its many forms and therefore not limited to an armed struggle, the excuse of, well, Palestine's different, or in today's context, things are really different, we can't use the same methods that we did back then, are given amongst many. Internalized Islamophobia has also enabled our obsession with convincing non-Muslims of our non-violent and peaceful nature, so that we're taking things a step further and dangerously condemning the resistance, branding groups and individuals as terrorists to dissociate from them, but at the same time supporting their liberation, which is a very strange contradiction.
Yeah, she is now the leader of the National Union of Students in the UK, Confederation of Students Unions in the United Kingdom. Around 600 students unions are affiliated, accounting for more than 95% of all higher and further education unions in the UK. And leaders are saying, hey, her comments, just like some of these parliamentary members, they are anti-Semitic comments. And when you listen to some of these things and see what's being posted and put out, it's really hard to deny. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's take a phone call. Haven't done that since the first hour. We go to Santa Clarita, California. Anthony, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. I was wondering if we claim that we worship the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, how come our Christian churches don't teach us anything to observe, let's say, the Feast of the Lord? How come we're so separated from that?
Yeah, I'll give you the positive answer and the negative answer. But first, let me just understand your perspective, sir. Are there things that you believe God wants Christians today to observe from the Old Testament? For example, Seventh-day Sabbath, feasts, circumcision of boys on the eighth day. Are there specific things that you think that God wants every Christian to follow, or just some select things for certain reasons?
I guess I wouldn't have an answer to that. I mean, I don't see, you know, if they should do certain things or not certain things.
Got it. All right. Yeah. Well, let me just suggest that a larger theology is needed, whereby you or Christian leaders or others have really thought through the larger issues. Because if we're not under the law but under grace, what does that mean? If a new and better covenant has been established, what does that mean? If Gentiles don't have to become Jews in order to be saved or have equal status with Jewish believers, what does that mean? So here's the positive answer, then I'll give you the negative, all right? Because it is a genuine issue. The positive answer is that by Jesus the Messiah coming into the world and making Jew and Gentile one in him, that it was not necessary for a Gentile to convert to Judaism. It was not necessary for a Gentile to take on the yoke of the law. But that Gentile believer, through Yeshua, could have exact equal status with the Jewish believer in terms of equal access to God, God being the father of both equally, both being spiritual priests to God, both being branches of the vine, both being members of the body equally in that respect. And that's part of what's laid out in Acts, the 15th chapter, that the Gentiles don't have to take on the entire yoke of the law. That's what Paul argues for in the book of Galatians, telling Galatian believers, you do not have to become circumcised and take on the law in order to be right with God. In fact, if you do that, you fall from grace. And no one said that Gentile Christians couldn't develop their own traditions. No one said that Gentile Christians couldn't even develop a calendar with things that were special, or each community around the world have something that it followed. So on the positive side, everyone is not under the Sinai covenant today, and there is a new and better way, and we have a unity that transcends the calendar. That's on the one side. The negative side is this. The first Gentile believers got saved through the witness of the Jewish apostles, and some of them were already attending synagogue. They were what was called God-fearers. In other words, they honored the God of Israel, but they didn't convert to Judaism. So they knew the Jewish calendar. They would be in the synagogue on the Sabbath. They would know when the feast days and things were like that. So when Paul writes to the Corinthians, some of the Corinthians that first heard him, according to Acts, the 18th chapter, they heard Paul in the synagogue. So what were they doing in the synagogue? They were God-fearing Gentiles. So when Paul writes to them, he assumes they know what the Passover is. 1 Corinthians 5, he assumes they know what first fruits is. 1 Corinthians 15, he makes reference to that, probably with pointing back to the biblical calendar. So the negative answer, Anthony, is that as Gentile believers increased in number and Jewish believers were no longer the majority and then no longer the majority of leaders, that the Gentile believers did exactly what Paul warned about in Romans, the 11th chapter. They became arrogant through ignorance, and they acted as if this was their tree and the original branches were gone forever and they had now replaced them, that the church somehow became the new Israel. And rather than honoring the fathers, it cursed the fathers. Rather than saying we are drinking from this root through which Israel's nourishing sap runs, instead they cut themselves off from that root. So little by little, though, Anthony, things are turning. Little by little, there is a restoration taking place, not just Messianic congregations that have many Gentiles in them, but many churches celebrating tabernacles. Many churches are recognizing the beauty of the feast. So, Anthony, I believe there should be teaching. I believe there should at least be awareness of the calendar, what it symbolizes, what it means, and how the church as a whole partakes of it spiritually. We're getting in that direction little by little. Thank you, sir, for the call.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on the line of fire. 866-348-7884. When we expanded our broadcast, let's see, 5 years ago to reach many, many more stations across America, I said, I prayed and I really felt to do this. Let's be thematic on several days of the week. So Friday, you've got questions, we've got answers. We had often done that. Thursday, we made Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. In fact, it was a listener who came up with that because I was thinking, okay, Monday could be Monday's musings and Tuesday can be a theology teaching day and Wednesday a worldview day, Thursday a Jewish day, but we'd something that would rhyme with Thursday. And one of our listeners came up with Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And we vary a lot Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, what we cover. But often I'll make sure that we do a teaching or theology-oriented program on a Tuesday and Wednesday, a worldview-related program. And one reason is this. We're not one track here. This is not a political, conservative talk radio show. And every day I'm going to be talking about what's happening in politics. Every day I'm going to be talking about what's happening with the elections. Every day I'm going to be talking about what's happening morally, culturally, and national things, and so on. We are not exclusively a Christian teaching show, where every day I'm going to be talking about this biblical text and that biblical text. We're not exclusively apologetics, where every day we'll be talking about defense of the faith. And by the way, there are shows that is their exact calling, and that's what they're called to do. Some are called to be, speaking in silverware terms, a knife, and some a spoon, and some a fork. What do you call it, the spoon and the fork, a spork? Like a mixed one like that. Some are called to be a set of silverware, each one different. And we're not just exclusively an Israel show, Jewish show, but we cover all these different bases. And it's an expression of who I am, an expression of my calling. It's an expression of our larger ministry. Right now, for example, my materials translated into Hebrew are being used to reach Israelis on internet. As I speak, they're reaching Israelis on internet. Or translated into Spanish or Russian, reaching people by book form or video or things like that in other parts of the world. That's extraordinary. We're deeply blessed by it. At the same moment, we have grads from our ministry school who are preaching the gospel in countries like India, the Philippines, and Mexico, as I speak to you, depending on the time zone, so I might be sleeping. At the same time, we're on the front lines of moral cultural revolution, writing about these things, addressing these things. And we're always looking at political issues and trying to come from a kingdom perspective on those. And on it goes. And we're always doing apologetics and we're always teaching. So we felt it was important, as I prayed, for two reasons. One, that it's an expression of my life and calling here on radio that I get to share with you and serve you, playing my part in the body. And secondly, it would not allow us to ever get into a particular rut, meaning that we become focused on one thing. Oh, trust me, it would be easy if my calling was conservative talk radio to talk about politics every day. There's always something to talk about. Or if my calling was exclusively moral cultural revolution, and that's what I was going to focus on day and night, you better believe, you absolutely better believe that there'd be stuff to talk about every day. And the same with Israel, the same with apologetics, the same with just teaching. But this way, we can stay varied. And I'm always blessed when I meet listeners that so many of you will say to me that that's one of the things you enjoy most about the broadcast, the different ground that we cover on the air, the different subjects that we cover. But many times, people will tell me that their favorite day is either Thursday or Friday, either Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. You've got questions, we've got answers. That's today, that's tomorrow. We're on it. Okay, we'll be right back. I'm going to be answering some Jewish-related questions when we come back.
Change the world.
Hey, this is Michael Brown. I want to invite you to join me for our second ever trip to Israel, February 25th through March 6th, 2017. This is a great opportunity. I get to interact with you, our radio listening audience, and our ministry partners as we experience the land of Israel together, and it will be a life changer. We've got a great price on the trip, and if you're one of our monthly supporters or torchbearers, you're eligible to receive a special discount for this once-in-a-lifetime experience. Space is limited, and we're accepting applications on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information on the trip to secure your spot, go to AskDrBrown.org, click on the Israel banner, or call our office at 704-782-3760.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you for being part of this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Yeah, early in the year, reports European anti-Semitism likely to grow in 2016. Talk about that. Talk about that. Yeah, I mean, is that a no-brainer kind of statement or what? You could not even have to read the news and have your eyes closed and your ears covered and make that prediction pretty easily, just if you've lived anywhere other than behind a rock somewhere in the last several years. So sad to say that. If you've got a Jewish-related question, a Hebrew-related question, Jewish tradition, Israel-related question, give me a call. We'll do our best to answer. 866-348-7884. I did post on Facebook, and I invited folks to join me there. So said, hey, if you want to ask your questions, I'm going to answer some on the air. So here's one from Joseph. I loved your broadcast on April 21st when you explained the different ways that a Jewish person can be defined. For example, ethnic, religious, national. I've recently seen an increase in people thinking, mostly being propagated by Hebrew Roots Movement One Law theology teachers, that a Gentile believer in Yeshua is now part of Israel, is a spiritual Jew. Why do you think this incorrect doctrine is gaining popularity? Joseph, doctrines like this have been around for centuries and centuries. On the one hand, it's very easy for a Christian to find deep identification with Israel and the Jewish people. It's very easy to say, hey, God made his covenant promises with Israel. Now those covenant promises are now extended to us. We are now sons and daughters of the living God. We are now the temple of the Spirit. We are now a part of this new body that Yeshua constituted. He, after all, chose 12 disciples, didn't he? It represents the 12 tribes of Israel. And now we are followers of Yeshua through those disciples. And there are many parallel descriptions between Gentile believers in the New Testament and Israel in the Old Testament. Even Paul, writing to the Romans in 9 through 11, while he emphatically says Israel is Israel, and there's a remnant of believers within Israel, the Israel within Israel, Romans 9, 6, and he emphatically refers to the people of the nations as Gentiles, says, I'm writing to you Gentiles. So he doesn't say I'm writing to you spiritual Jews, I'm writing to you Gentiles. I want you to provoke my people Israel to envy. Yet, at the same time, Paul applies passages, say, in Hosea, where God speaks of his people Israel as you were my people, I rejected you, so you were not my people, but now you are my people. Paul applies that to Gentiles, the ultimate not my people who have become the people of God. And in Romans 2, verses 28 and 29, could easily be interpreted to say that a Gentile believer that lives by God's moral code, even though not a Jew, is a Jew at heart, is circumcised in heart. So it'd be very easy to read things like that. You might even read Paul saying that in Philippians 3, we are the true circumcision. And some think he's just talking about himself and his Jewish colleagues as apostles, but others think, no, he's writing to the Gentile Philippians as well. That could be that there is, in a sense, that the body takes on the spiritual qualities of Israel. And yet, Paul never explicitly refers to Gentile believers as spiritual Jews. Paul never explicitly refers to the church as Israel. Galatians 6:16, where he speaks of the Israel of God, most likely is talking about Jewish followers of Yeshua there, as opposed to Gentiles. In fact, it would be utterly contradictory, not only the less likely grammatical possibility, to say that after rebuking them for the better part of five chapters, in the strongest terms we have anywhere in the New Testament of Paul's writings, and I'm basically saying, I wish those that are trying to force you to be circumcised would go the whole way. Maybe he's even saying castrate themselves. Very strong language. Who has bewitched you, Galatians? It would be very strange that after five chapters of rebuking them for thinking that they had to become Torah-observant Jews to be right with God, he would now call them the Israel of God. What? I thought you told us we didn't. Why? I don't get that. So it's not even logical, let alone it is not the most logical or grammatical reading of Galatians 6:16. All that being said, over the years, the church, by believing it was spiritual Israel, the church, by believing it had replaced the Jewish people, that was the old one, we're the new one, they were of the flesh, we're of the spirit, having that notion led to anti-Semitism, led to persecution of the Jews in Jesus' name, as horrible as that is to say. So why do you have these movements recurring in recent years, or even more? Well, because there is a greater recognition that God is not done with Israel and the Jewish people. It's really impossible to say that when you look at world history and the prominence of Israel today and the supernatural restoration of Israel to the land. It's impossible to deny that. Some deny it, but I say you really can't and be scriptural at the same time. I argue for that very, very strongly. So, in point of fact, there's a recognition of Israel's importance, and some Gentiles who do not rightly understand their standing in Yeshua, who do not rightly understand that everything they need is found in him, that a spiritual Gentile is equal to a spiritual Jew, that a spiritual Gentile is not required to keep the law of Moses, that one must not find some type of blood connection to Israel or identify as a tribe of Israel to be spiritual. If they do not understand that, all of the in him, in Christ teaching that Paul has in the New Testament, if they do not sufficiently understand that, then they will look for some type of validation as Jews. And then some of them dress as Jews and they start living by Jewish law. And I know some who have actually apostatized. They have turned away completely from the Messiah by Gentiles thinking they had to become Jews and then thinking, well, they had become more religious Jews, and the more religious they came, the less they focused on Yeshua, and they ultimately turned away from the Messiah of Israel entirely. And some have converted to Orthodox Judaism. I know people to whom that's happened. But I warned about it for years. It's not a surprise when that happens because they put their identity in the wrong place. I hope this is making sense to you. 866-348-7884. Can I answer another Facebook question? Let's see. Scroll down. All right, it's three questions by the same person, but I'm going to do it. Carrie, do the Jews consider the Messiah to be the same as God, or they consider them two different entities? Two different entities, for sure. Two different entities. God sends the Messiah. By the way, that's the primary message. That is the primary message of the New Testament. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, both Lord and Messiah. God sent his Son into the world. God has raised Yeshua up as the Messiah. What we understand through reflection and study and prayer is that the Messiah himself is divine. But no, Jews do not look at God as the Messiah or the Messiah as God. Another question, do the Jews think the Son of Man in Daniel is God himself? No. No, they would say there's the Ancient of Days and there's one like a Son of Man, highly exalted. But some say it's the Messiah. Some say it is King Messiah. So there is rabbinic interpretation that says that in Daniel 7, verses 13 and 14. Other traditional Jewish interpretation says, no, that just represents Israel. When you go to the end of the chapter, you'll see that the Son of Man represents Israel. And the nations then serve God through serving Israel. But there's a strong argument that can be made and is accepted in a lot of traditional Jewish interpretation that the Son of Man in Daniel 7, 13 and 14, who is highly exalted, is the Messiah. So as I explained earlier, Traditional Jews do not believe in a divine Messiah, but many believe in a highly exalted Messiah. All right, got all those questions answered. Can I get to, let's see. Okay, one more from Carrie. How is it that Christians claim that the new covenant mentioned in Jeremiah has already occurred, when if you finish reading the chapter, you can clearly see that we're still teaching one another to obey the instructions? I see the Jewish interpretations making more sense. This occurs in the last day when all nations come into observance of Torah during the Messianic Age. Easy, Carrie. Of course, I answer that in some depth in Volume 4 of my series, but we're enjoying the first fruits of it. Just like the Sinai Covenant has ultimate goals, and the Sinai Covenant, if you obey me fully, then you'll be a priestly nation to me, etc. Of course, Israel never saw those goals realized. We will see the goals of the New Covenant realized, but we're in the first fruits of it. I've experienced forgiveness of sins. I've experienced new life in the Messiah. And we have all experienced through new life in Him, where the Holy Spirit does teach us the fundamental things that we need to know.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, let me give you a little sampling here from some of the latest hate stuff that I've seen posted on social media, especially on YouTube. We get it a lot. People just responding to things I've posted, or here's a sweet Facebook one: boycott Israel. Netanyahu is a war criminal. Stop the Israeli terrorist regime. When we post it on YouTube, a video invitation to join us on our tour of Israel next year. If you haven't heard about it, February 25th to March 6th, it's a wonderful 10-day tour. It's a great price. The accommodations are great. The food's great. But much, much, much more importantly than that, the land, the experience of meeting Jewish believers there and Arab believers there, the places you'll see. Everybody that I talked to that went on our tour almost 2 years ago, they all thought it was a great deal. Most wanted to come back again immediately and immediately think of who they want to bring on the next tour. So you've got time to plan for this. But if you make your deposit this week, there's an additional $50 savings. And if you're one of our monthly supporters, a torchbearer, there's a special discount for you. Let's see. So someone responded to our tour invitation by saying, don't go to Jewish stolen land. So don't go to Israel because it's, quote, stolen land. And the reason I said it like that, because it was all in caps. And when I was talking about media bias against Israel, someone responded, media bias against Israel. I thought the Jews run the media. Oh, let's just see. Okay. Here's someone responding to things that I'm explaining about the Palestinians and some of the hatred towards the Israelis. A fellow named Rich says this: ask Dr. Brown, your channel is a joke. Disinformation and a bunch of exclamation points. Looks like at least six. History shows who are the aggressors. Just look at the Palestine-Israel map. Stop spreading your BS. Americans know Israel are bullies. God help Palestinians. Then he says, I hope Israel gets nuked. Zions, the Jews, are evil. They are war criminals. Yeah, this is some of the delightful stuff that gets posted on a regular basis. And the more they talk, the more they expose themselves. Someone standing up for Ann Coulter when she made some controversial statements that could be considered anti-Semitic. She was talking about Jews, Zionists, profanity. Ah, that's what we were pointing out. how about this one? As I'm correcting things that comments or balancing out comments that were made by Jon Snow, it was at Channel 4 in UK, major broadcaster there. Someone who is apparently Muslim based on the name. I don't have to listen to this BS radio speaker. Israel left Gaza because they couldn't fight the resistance there and their army was angering. I don't even know how to say it. They were defeated, and they weren't defeated. They did this to reach out to Palestinians. They did this under American pressure. They did this uprooting thousands of their own people, physically uprooting. People had lived there for years and built synagogues and homes and developed businesses. And if you were Palestinian there, you was a thriving community in terms of the standard of life was improved under Israeli rule. Yeah, these are easily obtained facts. And you could just go there, Israeli, go in there and shop and among Palestinians, etc. And when Israel turned it over to the Palestinians, then they vote Hamas in as leaders, and Hamas is the one oppressing them. Hamas is spending multiplied tens of millions of dollars of aid being sent in internationally. Hamas is using the money to build terror tunnels going into Israel and to build up its arsenal again as the people suffer. I think it was the widow of Yasser Arafat who even talked about that, about the suffering of the Palestinians under Hamas. They keep doing assassinations of the resistance and political leaders from the air. They keep the control, the entrance of food and water, which they polluted many times. They refuse to let the Gazans move and travel for treatment or education. Do you know how much aid Israel brings into Gaza on a weekly basis? Do you know how many people that are hurting and in need in Gaza that Israel treats? And you know the only reason for the blockade? There's only one reason. And by the way, Egypt does the same thing to Gaza. It is to stop the importing of weapons and to stop the exporting of terror. That's the only reason. If the people of Gaza did not have Hamas as their leaders and were living peacefully, they would be thriving. The Israelis are evil, and those Jewish settlers are the main cause of the conflict because they're controlling the government, and that's why peace will never be achieved in Gaza, Iraq. Propaganda, propaganda, propaganda. That's all that is. It is true, no one likes the Jews. They are profanity. 95% are profanity. They've been kicked out of every nation they have inhabited. Here's another Facebook post. This comes in day and night, just to give you a feel of what's out there. Jews are evil. Most of them. Christ Jesus was not a Jew. Christ Jesus was not a Jew. Do you get the feel for this? Here again, responding to a YouTube video, The Truth About the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. The criminal Zionist state of today, which is a state sponsor of terrorism, has nothing in common with the Israel of the Bible. The reason why the number of Christian Palestinians is decreasing in Palestine is because the Zionist state is carrying out ethnic cleansing against them. Bogus, lie, complete, utter, 100% nonsense, rubbish. Palestinian Christians are not suffering under Israel. Live in Israel and worship with complete freedom. And convert from Islam to Christianity or Christianity to Islam with no penalty from the government and no honor killings supported by the government. No. Palestinian Christians are decreasing because of Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Israel carrying out ethnic cleansing against them. That is a bold-faced lie. And someone else responding to my apologetic series on YouTube, because Jews are evil and they are the children of Satan. Jews took Satan's offer, which Christ refused. Friends, it's a plague. Anti-Semitism, Jew-hating sentiments, they are a plague. It is rampant in the world today. We must combat it spiritually, and we must combat it with truth. And I urge you, keep listening to this broadcast so that you can get dissuaded from some of these satanic, destructive, ugly lies and know how to address them. Again, friends, visit the website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Visit there and check out our Israel tour. Any way you can join us, February 25th to March 6th of next year. We just announced it this week. My bottom line today, the bigger the lie, the harder it will fall. And that's what's going to happen when the King Messiah who returns will be a glorified